From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's not news that there aren't enough donor organs to go around. Transplant lists are long, and the older we get, the more replacement parts we need. Hips, knees, kidneys, lungs, even a heart. Far more than are received through donors. Now scientists say they may have found the answer. Grow the organs we need in a lab, printed on a 3D printer, covered with patients' own cells. It's not science fiction anymore. This hour On Point, growing the organs we need in the lab to solve the nation's organ shortage. You can join us on air or online. Can the answer to our transplant troubles be found in the lab? Could this save your life or the life of your child? Would you feel comfortable with a lab-grown part? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first from New York is Malcolm Ritter, science reporter for the Associated Press. His new piece is To Ease Shortage of Organs, Grow Them in a Lab, looks at the growing world of growing organs inside the lab as an alternative to traditional organ donation. You can link to it at our website at onpointradio.org. Malcolm Ritter, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane. Good to be here.
So organ transplants have been very much in the news lately, especially in light of the case of little Sarah Murnahan. She's that little girl, 10-year-old, whose parents successfully sued to get her on the adult transplant list. Tell us how she's doing.
As far as I know, she's doing fine. The information has been a little scarce, but it's all been good so far. I think she's doing just fine.
Help us understand the organ shortage in this country. How serious is it?
Well, there are more than 100,000 people right now in the U.S. Waiting for organs, kidneys, livers, pancreas, heart, lung. And that, as you mentioned, that shortage has been around for quite a long time. It's been a stubborn problem that's been difficult to solve.
What's been the reaction to Sarah's story from the National Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network? They oversee organ transplants in this country. This was a difficult case.
This was a difficult case, and last week the National Transplant Network created a special appeals process for children like her who need lungs, although they declined to automatically put them on the adult waiting list, which was the deal that Sarah got through the judge's order. So they've put in place an appeals process, and we'll see how that works.
So you've been looking at organ transplantation in a very different way, Malcolm. Tell us about the science of actually growing these custom-made organs in a laboratory. Sounds like science fiction on the face of it.
It does sound like science fiction, but, to some extent, there's some baby steps going on already. There are actually dozens of people who have bladders. They're walking around with bladders that were made for them in a lab from their own cells. There are a few people with blood vessels who had that again were made in a lab for them from their own cells. More than a dozen surgeries have put windpipes into people, again with their own cells. These are basically tubes and sheets and containers. They're fairly simple things, and yet they're sort of baby steps toward solid organs, which are much more complicated to make. But there's some early work in the labs that indicates that it may be possible.
So windpipes, tubes, sheets, containers, that sort of thing that's more simple. We'll get into the specifics of how this all works with a researcher in just a moment. But so the liver, the heart, the lungs, that's more difficult, obviously, because it's more solid material.
It's more solid material, and that means you have to think about the blood vessels to get the blood to feed all those cells in this big 3D configuration. It's more complicated for that reason.
Let's get some sound here from Thursday. This is after Sarah Murnahan's lung transplant surgery at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. Her aunt, Sharon Ruddick, said that the family was thankful for the lungs that will now keep Sarah alive.
We're very, very, very excited, and we're very, very thankful. We're quite certain we were down to the last week, so that wonderful family gave us the best gift ever, and we are really happy for that. We can't imagine their pain, but we're thankful for what they did for us.
Malcolm Ritter, the standard today, then, is someone has to die for a heart or a lung to become available. Sounds like science is moving toward changing that, growing these organs in a lab. That would change everything, would it not?
It would be, and it'll be interesting to see just which organs become available in this way and how soon. And when you ask these scientists, when are we actually going to see this, in people, you get answers all over the map. If you ask, well, how long until these organs are first tested in humans, you hear 5 to 10 years, you hear 15 to 20 years. So it's a way in the future. But they're optimistic. One of them said, you know, you have to be an optimist to work in this field. And once they come along, there will be questions about access, you know, who can afford these things and who can't and how equitable is that. But it does appear to be coming.
The controversy over the use of stem cells is not an issue here because what we're talking about is using a patient's existing cells, actually from their own bone marrow, correct?
That's right. That's one of the sources for cells that would be used here. It's a question, of course, the controversy has been embryonic stem cells. Those are cells that are derived from an embryo that can turn into any kind of cell type in the body. Whether those will be necessary for this to build organs is not clear. There are other alternatives now, the so-called iPS cells, where you basically genetically reprogram a skin cell or a blood cell and turn it into a more primitive cell and then nudge that cell toward the kind of cell you want it to be. That's an alternative, too. So when we talk about stem cells here, as you say, this is not the embryonic stem cell. This is the kind of stem cell that comes from the patient's own body, and there's no big controversy about that.
I'm reading a lot in conjunction with this that even in the late 1980s, scientists didn't believe that it was possible to make, quote-unquote, make human organs. What was the tipping point? Was it technology? Was it advances in the science itself? I mean, we've come so far so fast.
Yes, and it's been an interesting sort of a race between tissue engineering, which is working with the cells themselves, and sort of the science of understanding how those cells work. I think the development of, as I mentioned, these cells where you can sort of transmute them from one kind to another has been a big breakthrough in that area, and also the development of scaffolding, which is basically the scaffolding for organs that you place the cells on. I think advances have come there that make people think, yeah, you know, we might be able to do that.
Here's Dr. Anthony Atala. He's director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and his team developed the first lab-grown organ. It was a bladder implanted into a patient. Here he's talking about explaining the use and the value of regenerative tissue research in a 2009 TED Talk.
As we age, our organs tend to fail more. So that's a challenge, not just for organs, but also for tissues. Trying to replace pancreas, trying to replace nerves that can help us with Parkinson's. These are major issues. This is actually a very stunning statistic. Every 30 seconds, a patient dies from diseases that could be treated with tissue regeneration or replacement.
That's so incredible. So is the major focus growing organs for transplant, Malcolm, or are there other benefits to this research for other things?
Well, there are the focus of the research that I was writing about specifically was indeed growing organs, although there are other payoffs from this. One researcher told me, you know, the things we learn about growing organs could help us keep regular organs, regular donated organs, viable for a longer time. We may learn secrets about keeping them viable that would make standard transplants easier. So there are some spin-offs here.
Is there a scenario here where organs can be grown and banked or stored so that patients would come and essentially order up what they need when they need it?
Well, sort of. Basically, the dream scenario I hear is that if you need an organ, you donate some of your cells, and then they turn to a scaffolding. It's an inert scaffolding, and a very detailed scaffolding in the shape of the organ you need, and that's off the shelf. That's just sitting there. And they would take your cells or cells that they've made out of your cells and seed them onto this scaffolding and incubate it for a while, and that would become your organ. So the whole organ wouldn't be banked, but the scaffolding would be banked. And with luck, it would go right back into you. It would have your own cells, so there shouldn't be an organ rejection problem. And even if it's not the perfect organ, you know, it just has to be a good enough organ, a good enough kidney to get you off dialysis. It may not be the perfect kidney, but it might be good enough.
Hey, good can be great, as they say sometimes. In some cases, this scaffolding created actually like on a 3D printer, right?
That's right. Played that clip from Dr. Atala in his lab. They are making prototype kidneys with a 3D printer. Rather than ink, they lay down sort of a gel-like material that hardens into a scaffolding, and they lay down many types of kidney cells at the same time. And layer by layer, they build up these little prototype kidneys, which they are studying to see if they can make them work.
This research is happening a lot in Europe, right? I mean, is it sort of slowly trickling into the United States?
Well, I think there's a pretty robust program in the United States. I found a lot of people to talk to here. You're right. There's a lot of work going on in Europe, but I think there's a pretty impressive amount going on here, too.
And so based on your reporting on this story, Malcolm Ritter for the Associated Press, this is really a solution for organ transplantation in the near future, 5 years, 10 years down the road?
It's just hard to say. You know, whenever you ask scientists this question, they really shy back from putting numbers on it, and I have to appreciate that. I can only quote some numbers, maybe 5 to 10, 15, 20 years to the first tests, and they may not work. So it's awful hard to put a number on it and say, you know, in this many years, people will routinely be able to go in and get a new kidney, a new liver. The hope is that at some point, before too long anyway,
that it's coming.
Will be the case.
Malcolm
Ritter,
thank you very much. Science reporter for the Associated Press, focusing on biological research news. His piece is "To Ease the Shortage of Organs, Grow Them in a Lab." I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the science of growing organs in a lab to solve our nation's donor shortage. With me now from Columbus, Ohio, is Dr. Christopher Brewer, co-director of the Tissue Engineering Program at the Nationwide Children's Hospital and director of the Tissue Engineering at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center's Center for Regenerative Medicine and Cell-Based Therapies. In 2011, he and his team conducted the first American tissue-engineered blood vessel transplant. Dr. Christopher Brewer, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So tell us about that procedure. How did it go?
Sure. Fortunately, it went very well. Our product is a product called a tissue-engineered vasculograft. And what it is, it's a conduit that's used in an operation to connect one blood vessel to another. And in this particular case, it was used in the surgical repair of a little three-year-old girl who had a congenital heart problem. She was born with what's called a single ventricle cardiac anomaly, where she was born with half a heart. And in this operation, you need to use a very large vascular graft to connect the inferior vena cava, the biggest vein in the body, to the pulmonary artery. And currently used man-made synthetic grafts are a significant source of complications. So for the past two decades, we've been working very hard to try and create a better vascular graft and came up with this tissue-engineered vascular graft. And this patient was implanted approximately 2 years ago. It'll be 2 years in August. Mm. And fortunately, the surgery went very well. Mm.
How close is that organ-grown vessel, that synthetic vessel, if you will, how close is it to the real thing? Is it as durable as the real vessel in her heart?
Sure. So that's a very interesting question. So what we actually place in the patient is very different from a blood vessel. But over time, it remodels in the body and becomes, in all intents and purposes, a real blood vessel. So the way the graft is made is we start with a biodegradable tube, a tube that's made from materials that dissolve when they're exposed to water. They degrade by hydrolysis. And when these tubes are placed in the body, they slowly begin to break down. But at the same time, the body begins to invade the tube with its own immune cells. Additionally, we seed the graft with some other cells from the patient, cells that are derived from the bone marrow. And what happens over time is the tissue regenerates. And in this case, the resulting tissue that forms is vascular tissue. And it has the same cellular and histologic composition that a real blood vessel has. So the inner lining cells are called the endothelial cells. They're exactly the same as in a regular blood vessel. The middle layer is called the media, and that's composed of smooth muscle cells. And then the outer layer, adventitia, has a combination of fibroblasts and myofibroblasts. And what's interesting about these grafts is if you implant them in a vein, they regenerate a vein. If you implant them in an artery, they regenerate an artery. Mm. But what's being studied in the clinic now is the vein.
And so expand that process then to what we're hearing from Malcolm Ritter, who has been reporting on this, to, you know, kidneys and livers and hearts and lungs. How far does this go?
Sure. So I think it's an exciting time in tissue engineering, and it's exciting for a variety of reasons. I think we're seeing sort of the next wave of tissue engineered products to be brought into the clinic, and we're still dealing on things with products that are very simple. You know, we're talking about trying to create blood vessels, trying to create similar or simple structures as opposed to whole organs. But on the frontier, if you look at some of the other work that's going on in the country, within our animal work, whole organs are being created. Things like hearts and lungs and kidneys are being fabricated in the laboratory. Now, these are what are called proof-of-principle experiments, where there are studies performed to show the potential for tissue engineering. There are still significant issues that would need to be worked out before anything like this could be brought to the clinic. But it doesn't take a big leap of faith to see that if you can safely bring a blood vessel into the clinic and you're using a similar sort of technique, that other more complicated products could be brought along over time.
Let me play some sound here. I want to ask you more about this process of scaffolding that Malcolm Ritter introduced us to. I know you know all about it, but let me play this clip first. Dr. Anthony Atala, he's director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine. He led the first group to develop and implant a lab-grown organ. And here he talks about the process of gathering the cells needed to build that organ. This is at a 2009 TED Talk.
If a patient comes in to us with a diseased or injured organ, you can take a very small piece of tissue from that organ, less than half the size of a postage stamp. You can then tease that tissue apart and look at its basic components, the patient's own cells. You take those cells out, grow and expand those cells outside the body in large quantities, and then we then use scaffolds, materials. To the naked eye, they look like a piece of your blouse or your shirt. But actually, these materials are fairly complex, and they're designed to degrade once inside the body.
Dr. Brewer, talk about that process of scaffolding. What is the process of putting the cells from the body, or from outside the body, I guess synthetic cells as well, and scaffolding them together to create this?
So Dr. Atala is a great surgeon scientist and a real pioneer in the field. But within the field of tissue engineering, there are several different schools of thought. A scaffold refers to a three-dimensional matrix, and the purpose of a scaffold within the science of tissue engineering is to provide sites for cell attachment and space for tissue formation. And in some of the more sophisticated scaffolds, it can actually serve as templates for tissue formation. So they actually provide some of the cues that help the cells grow and organize in the proper fashion so that they can form functional tissue. Tissue refers to groups of cells working together to perform a common function. So within tissue engineering, there are basically three schools of thought. One school of thought likes to make the scaffolds from man-made biodegradable materials.
Such as?
So in our case, that's the process that we use. Our scaffolds are typically made from the same material that absorbable sutures are made from. Specifically, we use polyglycolic acid, polylactic acid, and polycaprolactone. The commonality between all three of these polyesters is that they degrade when exposed to water, so these scaffolds will break down when implanted in the body, and they break down into monomers that are non-toxic, so they break down into smaller chemicals that can ultimately be excreted from the body and don't cause any problems.
Such as rejection.
Such as, a scaffold products could actually be toxic. They could actually poison the body if it was made from a material that didn't break down into something that was as benign as the sort of things that polyglycolic.
Okay, so that's one template.
The other template's a very interesting one. A number of scientists are using extracellular matrix. So extracellular matrix refers to the mostly proteins that cells all lie in. So if I take a tissue, any tissue, it's really composed of two things. There's a cellular component, the living component, but all those cells are embedded within a matrix that is excreted from the cell. The analogy I typically make are the cells are sort of like the bricks, and the scaffolding is sort of like the cement. And it turns out that you can treat any tissue, usually with chemicals like detergents or enzymes, and you can remove the cells and leave behind the extracellular matrix. And that extracellular matrix winds up being a fantastic scaffold. The cells like to grow on it. And it possesses many of the cues and templates that the cells can use to help organize themselves. So some of the most sophisticated tissue engineering right now, the tissue engineers who are creating whole organs, like Laura Nicholson, are using decellularized tissue and using that extracellular matrix as their scaffolds.
And what about the models that come from just a new 3D printer? It's so amazing.
Yeah, so that that's a method for fabricating using tissue engineering, and you can use either type of scaffold. So it's just a method of putting the cells and the scaffold together in a way to build larger, more complex structures.
Let's get a call in here from Shelby in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Shelby. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm in Boston, Jane.
Hi,
Shelby. This is fascinating, and it's good to see science moving in such directions. I would like to just put a word in for another point of view. I was a bone marrow donor through a registry anonymously for a woman who had leukemia. Unfortunately, she did survive. There was a process I went through this registry. I had a lot of counseling, a lot of help making the decision to do this. So it was a person-to-person exchange, quite an experience for me as well. And, of course, the woman survived. My point is there's something that people can do right now, which is indicate on your driver's license that you're willing to be an organ donor. And I would just like to not have us get so excited about science, big science, which costs a lot of money, to the exclusion of other ways of handling problems.
But what if, Shelby, there was a way to easily and inexpensively grow some of these organs in a lab? Would that be okay with you? Would you be comfortable with that in your body? Or if it were to save the life of your child, would you want that?
When it's your child, those bets are off the table. I'm making a philosophical point about how excited we are to run to big science. And I'm not, I didn't hear whether these methods are widely available yet, whether they're excessively expensive now.
Yep. Well, let's ask the doctor. Dr. Brewer, how accessible is this and how expensive is it?
Sure. So currently it's all under investigation. So we're in the midst of an FDA trial, so it's all experimental. As far as charges during the experimental phase, there are no charges involved. When a patient comes in, any costs associated with making these things are covered by the trial itself. But the caller brings up an incredibly important point, which is a very valid one and a very true one. There are many things that we can do currently without tissue engineering, and some of these problems are really what caused the development of tissue engineering, and a major one is called donor organ scarcity. So if you think about the science of surgery and specifically transplantation, there are incredible problems that we can fix. A patient can have terrible heart failure that can't be managed medically and they can get a new heart. Patient can have kidney failure and have a kidney transplant and their life can be saved. But it turns out that many, many, many people die awaiting for transplantation because there simply aren't enough organs to go around. And one of the reasons why tissue engineering developed was to try and overcome that problem. The indications for transplantation keeps increasing, while the number of organs available for transplantation remain fairly static. So I think that's an excellent point that needs to be addressed, and I would no way in shape or form suggest that we should tissue engineer when more organs should be available. The challenge with transplantation, though, is that there's still the problem of rejection.
Right.
And when I take bone marrow from the caller and put it into another patient, if they haven't received chemotherapy, that marrow is going to be rejected if it's not genetically identical. And when you take organs that aren't genetically identical and transplant them, patients need to be put on powerful immunosuppressives, and these immunosuppressives can cause infections, they can cause malignancies. Mm-hmm. And so there are significant hurdles that need to be overcome in order for transplantation to meet its true capabilities. And what tissue engineering does is it tries to overcome that. Because we can make these organs using your own cells, there's no problem with rejection. And because cells can replicate or regenerate, we can overcome that problem with donor organ scarcity.
Which is a major issue for so many patients. Dr. Brewer, thank you. Let me bring another voice into this conversation from Boston, Massachusetts, George Annis, Chair and Professor of Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights at the Boston University School of Public Health. He's the former chair of the Massachusetts Organ Transplant Task Force, and author of Worst Case Bioethics, Death, Disaster, and Public Health. George Annis, welcome back to On Point. Always nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane.
So what have you heard so far about the ethical use surrounding organ transplantation, the new issues of actually growing new organs? What do you hear in this conversation so far?
Well, a couple of things. The first one is that the Philadelphia case has just re-emphasized the fragileness of our basic agreement on how to ration human organs now. Who gets the next organ?
The case of little Sarah, who's 10 years old, whose parents sued to get her on the adult list.
I mean, exactly. I mean, as many commentators have said, that is not the way to get an organ for your child, is to bring a lawsuit. Everybody could bring a lawsuit. And what we've tried to do and have done more or less successfully over the last 40 years is set up a system that's transparent, that tries to be fair, that puts people basically on a waiting list in line and does them first come, first serve on the basis of medical need. And again, that's worked out pretty well. On the other hand, just right under the surface is people trying to jump the queue, and that can happen. And someone said, Ray Shelby, I think, knows, if it's your child, you do whatever you can do. You know, nobody's second-guessing the parents. That's why we need a system to ration organs that the public all sees as fair.
So where is this all going then, George Annis, from an ethical perspective? You talk about growing organs in a laboratory. I mean, it sounds so amazing, so promising for so many people. But from an ethical perspective, are there any issues or problems?
Well, I mean, Dr. Brewer put the case very well. I mean, he did argue that one of the major reasons he's involved in this research and his fellow researchers are is the organ donor shortage, again, and that in an ideal world, everybody would get an organ or a tissue if they needed it to continue to survive, which, of course, raises the question, how long do we want to survive? I mean, I think that the point is that more and more people are on the waiting list, many because they're old. We have this little girl who's 10. Obviously, that doesn't count. No one would begrudge her an organ. But is there an age limit? Is there a limit to what we should do with our healthcare system to keep people alive at near the end of life? I mean, the older I get, the more I think it's not that big a deal. But you know, would we grow one of these organs? And it may depend on how much it costs for a 90-year-old, 100-year-old person, whose organs are deteriorating. All of our organs are going to deteriorate at some point.
Right, and so does it become like a replacement organ becomes like a car part? When you need one, you just go get it replaced. And what is that? So talk about human mortality. Do we all live forever then?
Well, I think it almost looks like that's our goal. I mean, we know realistically none of us really think immortality is our goal, but we act as if we do. We act as if that's what the healthcare system should do. It should be there to repair whatever goes wrong with our body. And you can think of it like a car. You're absolutely right. We're very mechanistic when we think about our body. And, it's not uncommon at all for people to get new knees and new hips. And it's more uncommon to get a new organ. But, the body really is more and more looked at as something that when parts of it wear out, we should replace those parts.
And from your perspective, do you worry about this becoming so commonplace or really the potential for big business to sort of step in? And do you worry that this might be available at tremendous cost, the haves and the have-nots? Does this become for the rich only? I mean, there are lots of sub-questions here.
There are. I wouldn't, I think it's probably a little early to worry too much about that. I mean, we're talking God knows how long. Whatever people say, 10 to 20 years in the future, they really have no idea when this is going to come about. You may remember 30 years ago when Barney Clark got the first artificial heart, the physicians were saying within 20 years there'll be a million people with artificial hearts in the United States. Well, there's zero people with artificial hearts in the United States. What that induced actually were people to look at alternatives to artificial organs, and the main alternative has been regenerative medicine, which makes sense. I mean, it does make perfect sense. It's not coming tomorrow. It's not something you should look for right away.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the science of growing organs in a laboratory to solve our nation's donor shortage. With me today, Dr. Christopher Brewer, co-director of the Tissue Engineering Program at the Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, and George Annis, professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at the Boston University School of Public Health. Let's go to the phones in Beverly, Massachusetts. Bob is on the line. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Hi. My daughter suffers from polyendocrine autoimmune disease, and my question is, if you were to create new tissues, new functioning organs for her out of her own stem cells, would one still expect her immune system to again destroy those new tissues, or would some sort of new reset happen, or would you have to sort of figure out some way to suppress her overactive immune system, I suppose you might say?
Bob, thanks. Let's turn that to Dr. Christopher Brewer there in Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Brewer, what do you say?
Sure. That's a very, very good and sophisticated question. If you implant a diseased cell, it's still going to be in diseased, so you'd have to figure out ways to overcome that. But as we begin to understand diseases, our ability to treat them on a cellular level has improved too. So in some scenarios, cells can be taken out of the body and treated to take care of the underlying disorder and then used for tissue engineering and regeneration.
So I get this straight. Sometimes you take the cells from the body outside the body and create a sort of scaffolding, could be from a 3D printer or whatever it may be, and then you put them back in the body. And sometimes you take synthetic cells from outside the body and implant them. Is that correct?
So the cells that are used to make tissue engineered products are typically taken from the individual into whom they're implanted. And when they're outside the body, it's an opportunity to treat those cells if there's a problem with them. So, for example, if a patient had a genetic problem, you could use genetic engineering to reverse that problem in the cell when it was outside the body, and then use that repaired cell to regenerate tissue that could be reimplanted back inside the body.
Here's another call from Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Hi, Stephen. Welcome.
Hey, Jane. Sounds like a science fiction so far.
Doesn't it? It does, indeed.
Yeah, it's wild. I just want to say that first caller, I totally agree with her, but she seemed to poo-poo the idea of investing in science. I heard, like, big science, almost like the big pharma thing. That seems to be a cultural thing in our society, like GMO, climate change. This is an anti-science thing. But as an investor, it pays dividends. But this Laura case, the leak, where she got a legal injunction to get, I mean, that really makes me weep. That's such a heartbreaking story. But I heard a good question posed. Does that mean now if I'm sick, all I need is a judge to get a legal injunction to get an organ? Has this become a legal free-for-all?
Stephen, thank you. George Annis, would you tackle that, our ethicist here?
Yeah, hopefully we're going to head that off at the pass. I mean, that would be like the worst possible scenario, is that instead of going to be evaluated at a hospital by a transplant team, you go to the judge.
But has it set a precedent? Did that case in Philadelphia, the little case of Sarah, the 10-year-old, did it set a precedent?
Every case, in a sense, sets a precedent. Thankfully, there are very few children who need lungs, but you're absolutely right that the parents of all the children who are on the lung wait list now have to decide whether they're obligated for the sake of their child to go to court. Now, the organ transplant, UNOS changed the rules, as we've heard before, to say that you can make an exception. If the patient's doctor asks the national board to make an exception, they can review it. And hopefully they'll go to UNOS instead of going to the organ people instead of going to the judge.
Here's Sam in Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
Well, first of all, kudos to science like this. But I do hope on the other side of the trials, though, that these sorts of procedures aren't so expensive that the average person can't afford them, or that it doesn't push insurance through the roof. But my main question for now, and this has been in a question in my mind for years, and that is, when it comes time that I might need an organ transplant or a donation of some sort, why couldn't I go to the head of the line, since I've been a donor a listed donor for years. Shouldn't donors be go to the top of the list? I was standing in line at a registry once, ready to renew my license, and the young woman in front of me was asked if she'd like to be listed as an organ donor, and she went, "Oh no, I couldn't do that." I mean, let's give some props to people who are willing to do that and want to offer it for humanity.
Sam, thank you. Georgianis, what would you say?
Well, you're not the only one who believes that. There are people that think that, exactly as you say, that you should be have some skin in the game, or you should be taking part of the organ transplant registry, or be a willing donor in order to, and if you are, you should be able to get some consideration for that. There are other people who actually think we should change the law in the United States to say that everybody is presumed to be an organ donor unless they've opted out. And, you know, I find that a little bit scary, but on the other hand, there's something to be said for that.
Here's Dave in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Dave. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
My question relates to my wife. She has chronic Crohn's disease, and it runs in her family. Her dad has little or no effect to his gastrointestinal tract, but she has major problems. She's been on restricted diet since she was like 15, 16 years old. Mm. And annually or biannually, I have to rush her to the emergency room if she gets a blockage or anything like that. I love her dearly, and I have been looking for, any kind of hope or ray of sunshine at the end of the tunnel for her. She's already looking at a diminished life expectancy. And like I said, I mean, her gastrointestinal tract is just riddled with weak spots or inflamed spots.
So this organ growing issue sounds like it would be one that you would consider, certainly something in the gastrointestinal area. Let's turn it to Dr. Brewer. What would you say? A couple of comments about this on the website as well. Replacement colons, replacement large intestines. Would that be a possibility? Dave, thanks so much for the call.
Yeah, great question. And I think it is a possibility. I think there's some wonderful research. There's an investigator named Miguel Bessner at Nationwide Children's Hospital who's working on tissue-engineered intestine. Another investigator named Tracy Grickscheid in California also is doing some very promising work. But I don't want to overpromise the technology. This work is all at a very early stage. It's in a preclinical stage, and it would be years before it would be available. But I think that the proof of principle, the technology is there. You know, 20 years ago when we were talking about making blood vessels, you know, people laughed at us and, said it's science fiction. But, you know, here we are 20 years later, and we're in the clinic. We're investigating them. There are going to be limitations. You know, there's never going to be the silver bullet, the cure-all. But, you know, progress is incremental, and we're trying to do our part.
When you talk about the process, Dr. Brewer, of growing an organ, is everyone capable of this? Is it easier to grow new cells for organs from younger patients?
Great question. So sick people tend to have sick cells, and it is much harder to grow cells from older patients. But there are techniques that are being developed now where you can improve the ability of the cells to replicate, and so advances are being made on that front also.
Here's Richard in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Richard. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Jane. My question is, if you grow cells from a cystic fibrosis person, for the new lungs, are the lungs still cystic fibrosis?
They would be unless you treated the cells. Now, cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease, so you could anticipate a scenario where you could remove the cells from the diseased patient, correct that one genetic abnormality that leads to the cystic fibrosis, and then use those cells to, create or tissue engineer a whole organ. These sorts of things are feasible. They're far from being available in the clinic, but it is technologically possible.
Dr. Brewer, remind us again, you talked about you don't want to overpromise anything to our caller, Dave, whose wife was dealing with Crohn's disease and is interested in, you know, some sort of transplant for the colon or the large intestine. Talk about what's available now for people in this brave new world of science of growing organs.
So as far as commercially available products are concerned, the most common or the currently available commercially available products that are tissue engineered are mainly skin products. So those are able to be purchased and used in the clinic. Almost everything else is under investigation. Examples of products that are under investigation include tissue-engineered lenses for the eyes. We're doing safety studies on tissue-engineered blood vessels. There are some safety studies ongoing for some bone and cartilage products. But that's pretty much what we're limited to at this point. Lots of things are in a preclinical phase where they're close to getting into those first-in-man studies and some of those early safety studies. But those are the primary things that are available. One notable exception, I forgot to mention some of the products of Dr. Atalas. He works on both bladders, ureters, and urethral replacement tissue.
Right, because I'm reading here a story, where is this from? Reuters, doctors in Sweden growing windpipes, bladders, lungs, other organs. That's actually happening overseas in Europe specifically, correct?
So clinically, that's one of the cartilage products, the windpipe or trachea. Has been implanted in a human. The lungs have not been implanted in humans yet. That's all animal work at this point.
Okay.
Typically, what's done is you start by working on a project in the lab. You simply work with the cells and try and optimize your scaffolding and the ways to put the cells on the scaffolding. Once that works, usually there are small animal studies that can be performed to, demonstrate feasibility. Then once you've got a functional small animal model, the next step is trying to validate those findings using large animal studies, and then only after that's done do you make your first attempt at a clinical application. And then clinical applications, before you do anything, you need to prove safety. So yeah. All the initial studies have to do with safety before you can even really get into the efficacy studies to see if these products work as well.
You talked about the skin products being available now for purchase. How much?
I don't know the price. I couldn't tell you that off the top of my head.
All right, let's go back to Will on the phone in Boston. Hi, Will. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I was wondering, I know that they speak a lot about that 125-year mark with, telomeres and cells having, a limited amount of divisions they can make. Will the new cells and the new tissues, do you find a way that you can get around that?
Okay, good question, Will. I'll turn it to the medical doctor, Christopher Brewer.
Yeah, there's been some interesting work by Laura Nicholson the telomere is a part of the gene and part of the chromosome, and they tend to shrink over the course of your lifetime, and the length of the telomere has a lot to do with how well the cell can replicate. And there's been a lot of very interesting work where you can treat the cell in such a way that the telomeres will grow, and when you do that, you improve the ability of the cells to replicate. Mm-hmm. So, there's some very exciting work on that front.
Mary is in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wonder if your guest can address the sale of organs on the black market and what effect that has on the shortage of available organs.
Hmm. All right, Mary, thank you. Let's see. Georgianis, would you like to speak to that?
Sure. I mean, there is a black market, mostly overseas in countries like India and Brazil, where you can exploit poor people to sell a kidney. And as far as I know, there's no black market in hearts and livers. That would require murdering someone, actually. But it is a problem. I think no one thinks it's a good idea to buy and sell organs.
There is a couple of comments on that on our Facebook page. Some people worry if you start compensating people for organs that would put unfair pressure on the poor into donating. I guess we're not to that point yet, the compensation piece, Georgianis.
Hopefully we're not. No, I think that we actually have federal legislation in the United States that dates back to 1984 that prohibits the purchase and sale of human organs for transplant. Mm. And I think rightfully so.
Lexington, Kentucky is where Jerry is. Jerry, welcome to the program. Glad you called.
Hi, Jane. Thank
Hi.
You.
Mm-hmm.
My comment and question is that we're now capable of saving lots of people genetically, both at the beginning of their lives, if they're born with genetic reason, for instance, the little girl earlier that was discussed that has the new vessel in her heart.
Mm-hmm.
Genetically, she should not have survived. And I know it's very hard to say that to a parent, but as a culture and as a society, we're now introducing a defective gene that's going to get reproduced and kept in the system. At the other end of it, we have people who, at the end of their lives, need to die to make room for the next people. We have 7.2 billion people on the planet, and some of them now get to live even longer because we're messing with the order of things, as it were.
Jerry, I hear you. Dr. Brewer, a lot of bioethical questions here still to be resolved.
Well, if you follow that line of logic, you know, further, you know, what about penicillin? What about antibiotics? You know, should we let children die of, you know, infectious diseases at an early state in life because they happen to catch it? Or can you try and do this responsibly?
Dr. Brewer, we're at the end of our hour here. It's been so interesting to hear all of this. Take us out on sort of looking down the road on the horizon. What do you see? We've talked about timelines. Nothing is for certain, 5, 10 years, 20 years down the road. But you're in the middle of it. You're doing it now. What do you see in the future?
Well, I think we're at an exciting time in regenerative medicine, and I think we're at an exciting time for two reasons. One reason is that the science is finally catching up with the technology. Some of the early studies in tissue engineering were quite fantastic, and there were amazing discoveries, but they were things that we could do, we could engineer, but we didn't really understand what was happening. Over the past two decades, there's been a lot of work and a lot of investigation trying to understand things on more of a cellular and molecular level. And when you can understand things on that level, it's very helpful because it enables you to do what's called rational design. You can really, in a very logical order, try and develop your product and improve your product in a stepwise fashion, as opposed to empiricism, which used to be the old model, where you know you made something with tissue engineering, it worked pretty well, but there was a problem, so you tried something new. So I think the introduction of more scientific rigor has been very great for tissue engineering. And the other big advancement is that the scientists and the clinicians and the regulatory agencies are working very, very carefully to advance this technology in the safest way possible. We're more than willing to crawl before we walk and walk before we crawl, but our number one issue is to try and introduce these technologies as safely as possible.
Dr. Christopher Brewer, Columbia, Ohio, from Nationwide Children's Hospital there in Columbus. Thank you very much for a really interesting hour. George Annis from Boston, Chair, Professor of Health Law at Boston University School of Public Health. Really appreciate both of you today and listeners as well. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.